You have probably heard by now about the large amount of trash that finds its way into our oceans. A lot of that trash is plastic. Today's guest has been studying the effects of plastic on the ocean and vice versa and can separate the facts from the fiction. Giora Proskurowski is a research scientist at the University of Washington, dividing his research between vents on the ocean floor and plastics floating in the ocean. He'll deliver a lecture on plastic in the global ocean Saturday night at 7 at the Hale Center for the Performing Arts at Southwestern Oregon Community College's campus in Coos Bay. Giora Proskurowski, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Am I pronouncing your name even close to correctly?
I'm very impressed that you are, yes.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. The combination of skills is really intriguing, the fact that you study vents on the bottom of the ocean, on the ocean floor itself, and also study plastic on top of it. Is that an unusual combination of skills and study areas?
Yeah, I sort of backed my way into the plastic research. I guess the main point there is that in order to study the ocean, because it's such a dynamic and complex place, you really have to have a skill set that goes from chemistry and biology to physics and geology. And so you're sort of an interdisciplinary scientist to begin with when you start to study the ocean. And so, switching from the seafloor to the sea surface is certainly an environmental change, but the approach, this multidisciplinary approach still applies. And so I think that's sort of how I got into both at the same time.
Since most of us think of the ocean as, well, there's a lot of water out there, I mean, the fact is I can imagine there would be huge differences from the top and bottom of the ocean. I mean, that what's there in the water column differs greatly from place to place, from elevation to elevation.
Yeah, I remember when I was first starting in graduate school and taking water samples and just being nonplussed at the idea that it all just looks like water. And, you know, all the samples look the same, but the trick is that oceanography is a very subtle science, but those subtle differences can make all the difference in the way that chemicals or biology responds to the environment.
Did you see plastic in the ocean? Have you seen it on your way out to study vents on the ocean floor, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, anybody that gets out into the far offshore environments will see accumulations of plastic. The thing is, you see the larger pieces, the floating buoys, and the nets that you might drift by, and then the larger pieces. What you don't see is the smaller pieces until you go take a close look and do some surface net tows.
So straighten out the myth and the reality. I mean, because there's probably that famous picture that everybody's seen by now, and it looks like somebody in a canoe going through all these bottles and floating stuff on the surface. And it turns out to be a picture from Manila Bay. It's not actually from the North Pacific. But
right.
So what is out there? I mean, you've seen it or seen what is there. What is there?
Yeah, so, and I think that is the important point, is that there doesn't need to be any exaggeration about the scope of the problem. It's just that the oceans are so large and so vast that it's hard to state the problem in a way that people relate to. These regions of polluted areas in the ocean with plastic, at least, are in the Pacific, are maybe at least the size of the United States, if not bigger. But, you know, because nobody lives there, nobody really goes there except for, cargo ships transiting the Pacific, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And so you do see these pictures of people in Manila Bay. You can see that there's water lilies in that picture. I know the exact one you're talking about. Or there's other pictures where it's a coastal environment in like a secluded bay with all the trash pushed into a corner. And really, that they don't need to be. Those images are not what's out in the middle of the ocean. What's out in the middle of the ocean is you have the larger the floating fishing buoys and that type of thing. But those are sort of isolated and one-off, and you see them now and then. What's really the heart of the problem is these, what we call microplastics, and these fragments that are millimeters, centimeter-sized pieces of plastic that are in large concentrations in these millions of square mile regions. And another important point is that the concentration of these things, a very high concentration, would be one piece of plastic per square meter. Right? So if you think of that, like on your table, one piece of plastic in that square meter, that doesn't seem like a lot of plastic. But because the ocean is made up of so many hundreds of millions of those one square meter blocks, it turns out to be an incredible amount of plastic.
And is there a particular reason that the plastic collects in parts of the ocean? I know we've heard a fair amount about the North Pacific gyre. I guess gyres are not unusual in any ocean.
Right. So gyres is basically the fundamental physics of the Earth is what creates these gyres. When you have a spinning the spinning ball, the forces in that spinning ball drive these areas of low wind and low currents at these 30 degrees north and south latitudes. So if there were no continents on and it was just a water world, we'd have these regions around 30 degrees north and south where there'd be low winds and currents. That's the doldrums, right? But they'd be throughout the globe. That we have continents separating the ocean basins. We have five of these major ocean gyres: the North Pacific, South Pacific, North Atlantic, South Atlantic, and the Indian Ocean. So those are the five major ones. You know, there might be something in the Arctic as well, although the physics there are not as strong.
All right, we're talking about plastic in the ocean. We'll come back and pick up the conversation with Gior Proskurowski from the University of Washington on the Jefferson Exchange in just a few moments. Here's a reminder as we go to break. It is Fall Fun to Drive 2014, seeking your pledge of support to maintain the programming you have come to expect on Jefferson Public Radio. It is New Member Friday. Peter Sage will match every $45 new membership with $45 of his own. A great incentive. It's really driving up the new member numbers as we speak. We'll talk more about that as the hour goes on. You just need to call 888-552-6191 to make your pledge of support or pledge online at ijpr.org. Back on the Exchange with Dr. Proskurowski in just a moment. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the ocean and plastic in the ocean and separating the myth from the fact about the so-called garbage pile. It's not quite like that. There are little chips, micro pieces of plastic out in the ocean, and as we just heard, about one per square meter. Dr. Gior Proskurowski from the University of Washington is an oceanographer and a research scientist. He'll be talking about plastic in the global ocean Saturday night at 7 at SWOC, Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay at the Hale Center for the Performing Arts. You can join our discussion about the oceans and what is in them as far as plastic goes here on The Exchange now at 800-838-3760, 800-838-3760, and our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the way you describe a gyre, it sounds like what we would call an eddy in a river.
I mean, I think that's basically it if you consider the whole global ocean, so the whole ocean-covered surface of the Earth to be the river, and then there'd be these five major, major eddies. So eddy is a sort of a scaled term. We use the term eddy in oceanography as well, but it's a feature that's maybe a kilometer or 10 kilometers big, maybe even larger in some cases.
How long has it been then, Gior, since people started noticing plastic in the oceans, or has it been a very long time kind of thing?
Well, so that's an interesting question, and there is quite a history. You know, plastics really got their start in you know, human culture in the 50s and got very popular at that time. In the early 70s, there actually were reports of plastic in several publications in the late 70s. And it sort of got dismissed as a one-off. Nobody really cared or paid much attention to it, although it did, you know, it was in a major journal at that time. And then not until the late 80s did it really again come back into a publication in the scientific literature. But again, it was dismissed, and it wasn't really until the mid to late 90s that it started taking off in the cultural consciousness. But so, you know, it's been present in the oceans probably ever since it started being popularized. You know, once you get a piece of floating debris into the oceans, the physics is going to drive it to where it's going to be most stable in the environment, and that is in the middle of these gyres.
In the middle of the gyres, and very small as well. I mean, so what kinds of forces have happened? I mean, have these essentially been pulverized from larger bits of plastic into these little chips you're talking about a millimeter in size?
Yeah, you know, the research, the state of the research is really just getting into the mechanics of what happens, but undoubtedly that's what happens, is that larger pieces, you know, objects, you know, functional objects that have been discarded or lost to the environment do get broken down. Plastic is extremely susceptible to UV radiation. I mean, anything that's been outside for a while, you'll notice it's fade, it starts to crack, that type of thing. So when you're in a dynamic environment, you know, the surface ocean in these gyre regions is warm. You know, the sun is unrelenting in these spots on the Earth. And, yeah, I think that's the major mechanism is breakdown, mechanical breakdown.
Let us take a call. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about plastic in the ocean with Dr. Giora Proskorowski.
Many years ago, when the man who invented nylon for DuPont Corporation was being interviewed on NPR, he said, "You realize, don't you, that we are all going to drown in plastic?" And I would like to know if you would be willing to comment on that statement.
All right, interesting question. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're starting to get to that point where, you know, if you do make it to these regions, it's unavoidable that you see it. And I talk to captains that do the transoceanic crossings, and they know exactly where these places are because they can see from their huge ships, the bridge is, you know, up 120 feet, they can still see where the concentrations go up, and the large floating pieces are associated with these ever-present smaller pieces. I just wanted to make one more point about, you know, these regions. The whole global ocean is not uniformly distributed with these high concentrations of plastic. It's only concentrated in these gyre regions. Now, these gyre regions are gigantic, millions of square miles each, but it's not an even distribution across the whole global ocean. So there are these five major basins, and in the centers of them, basically, you get these really high concentrations of plastic.
I ran across a map yesterday, Giora, from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration that showed the North Pacific Gyre, and it seemed to show two clumps east and west on either end of that gyre. Is that the approximate collection of stuff?
Yeah, I think the major point is that 30 degrees north is sort of the center, north and south of those accumulation zones. In the North Pacific, which is the largest ocean basin in the world, right, that's the largest expanse of continuous ocean, it's forced a little bit to the eastern Pacific, so closer to the U.S. side, you know, east and north of Hawaii, then onto the western Pacific. But it is spread across the whole region, yes.
So we've been talking about the size of stuff. It is generally pretty small bits of plastic and not this idea of a bunch of floating antifreeze cans out there or something. But what I haven't asked about is how far down it goes. And as somebody who knows the water column pretty well from top to bottom, I mean, how deep is the plastic within these areas?
Yeah, this is one of my major contributions to the field is I was on a boat in 2009, and everybody had always just done surface net tows, skimming the surface ocean and then categorizing and counting the number of plastics and going from there. And it was a perfectly calm day, you know, so the ocean was totally flat, which is a very, very rare occurrence. And all of a sudden I could see all of the tiny little micro pieces of plastic, which you typically don't see. And what immediately struck me was that it had all floated up to the surface because there was no energy driving it downwards. So typically the upper ocean, which the oceanographers call the conductive boundary layer, is really a dynamic place where wind stress at the surface drives turbulence that goes down tens of meters. And so there's it's a vertical density gradient, which means that it takes very little energy to move a parcel of water, or in this case, a piece of plastic, from the surface down tens of meters. It takes very little effort to do that. And so when you have any wind stress at the surface, that drives plastic downwards into the water column. So the upshot of all of this is that when you sample just at the surface, you're only getting a portion of what's actually in the water column because some of it has been driven downwards just by this wind-driven turbulence. So to answer your question, the bulk of it still is at the surface, but in some cases, double or more can be also submerged below it in the top, say, 30 meters or 100 feet of the water column.
Wow, that deep. Okay, I thought it was more like 9 meters or something, but that deep, 100 feet deep, essentially, in the ocean.
Well, so it can be, you know, this what's called the upper mixed layer, this vertical density gradient, can be tens of meters in the summertime. In the wintertime, when you have really large storms coming through, that can go down to, say, 200 meters in some cases, just off our coast here in Oregon.
Let's take another call. We have Dave and Fortuna on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about plastic in the ocean with Dr. Giora Proskorowski.
Yes, I had a question here. They're starting to want to take all the plastic bags from the stores now here at a certain date. Do they have anything in mind to replace them with other than the paper?
No, I see. Yeah, plastic. You're right. In California, getting rid of plastic bags statewide, single-use plastic bags. I don't know. What sort of advocacy, if any, do you get involved with, Giora, about trying to find alternatives for plastics? Or is that not part of your efforts?
Yeah, I try to stay clear of the advocacy parts. I try to come at it from a scientist and an oceanographic perspective, making the case. I think the biggest case for this is that when I go out there and you see all of this plastic, we still have to figure out what it means to the ocean, but it's undeniable that humans are making a very, very large impact on very, very major portions of the Earth. And I think that is really one of the largest take-home points, is that, you know, our actions are altering the environment in massive ways. And so, I think that speaks for itself in terms of advocacy. In terms of, plastic bags, since we've done the same in Seattle, there's no plastic bags available in the supermarkets. I think it just raises the consciousness of using single-use plastics. You know, if you start doing that at the store, then maybe you start considering some of your other options. And I think every little bit helps.
How much we're talking to Giora Proskurowski. Dr. Giora Proskurowski is from the University of Washington, an oceanographer, a research scientist, and he studies plastic in the global ocean, which will be the topic of his talk tomorrow night at 7 at the Hale Center for the Performing Arts at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay. You can join us here now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, it's the same number, 800-838-3760, and our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. What kinds of plastic are we seeing out there the most, though? Because it was a good question from Dave about plastic bags, but I wonder if that is actually the largest portion of what you find out there. How much research has gone into what kinds of plastic and what the origins might be?
Okay, so I think that's two separate questions, and I have done quite a bit of research on the types of plastic. Overwhelmingly, the major component of this is polyethylene, which is corresponds with the major polymer type that's produced for plastics in consumer goods. The second major type is polypropylene, which goes along with that trend in production percentages of the different polymer types. What we don't see is polyethylene terephthalate, PET, which is your molded Coke bottles type plastic, the clear, harder plastic. And the reason for that is that PET is actually more dense than seawater. And so unless it has trapped air bubbles in it, it never makes it out into the middle of the gyres. They do see that PET in coastal environments and in coastal seafloor environments as well. But in the middle of the ocean, it's largely polyethylene, predominantly polyethylene, and then polypropylene, and sometimes foam polystyrene as well.
So if it's polyethylene, it comes from what then are we talking? What are the general sources of polyethylene?
Oh, right. So getting to the sources, the trick about plastic is that getting to the source is very, very difficult. And the reason for that is that what we see is basically these fragments. So we know that we have a small piece of plastic, we can characterize it in terms of its form and its composition. We know it's, say, polyethylene, but you don't really know where it came from in terms of even the object that it came from, nevertheless, where it was, what country it came from. And sometimes, even if you were to backtrack to a country, it's hard to say if it was produced there, used there, discarded there. So those are all very difficult questions.
All right. I guess what I was asking is not so much the country source, but the use of it. So, for example, if you're talking about polyethylene, if we found a different kind of container to use for, everything from dishwasher liquid to laundry detergent, would that make a big difference? I mean, is there one particular kind of plastic that shows up more than any other that you could say, if we stop making this kind of product or stop packaging these products with this stuff, we might have a different result in the ocean?
Yeah, so it's predominantly polyethylene, which is mostly consumer goods, one-use type deals. You know, there exists hundreds of thousands of different polymers and, hundreds of very, very viable degradable polymers that have good function. The real issue is that polyethylene is so cheap and so durable and so reliable that it's hard to get away from.
All right. So let's talk about some of the experiments that have gone on out in the ocean to look for plastic out there. I happened to catch a video online of you and some crew using a Tucker trawl. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the Tucker trawl is typically used in oceanography for multi-depth investigations of zooplankton, of these secondary producers, you know, these little critters that eat primary producers of phytoplankton. So they're little shrimps-type deals and other crustacean-like creatures, as well as a whole host of different organisms. But what we do with the Tucker trawl is we use it to isolate different depths of the ocean. So if I wanted to tow it 3 meters deep, I'd bring this device down to 3 meters and then open the net and tow for 15 minutes, say, and then close the net. And so when I bring it back up, I know that that net only saw this 3 meter below the surface region. Then I'd repeat that at 5 meters, 10 meters, 15 meters, which is, you know, that's a four-hour operation right there. But what we use the Tucker trawl is it's a multi-net device that allows me to isolate certain regions of the ocean.
All right, so you can pick at this point in the water column. I want to make an examination here. And how often do you generally keep it open? How far do you trawl with it?
Yeah, so on our surface tows, and a lot of this research I did with the Sea Education Association out of Woods Hole, Massachusetts. They're a private nonprofit educational group that's been going out to sea for the last 30 years. And during that 30-year period, taking students out to the middle of the ocean, so, you know, blue water far offshore, they do these surface net tows twice a day, one at midnight and one at noon-ish. And they have a standard protocol which tows for 30 minutes at about 2 knots. So you get about 1 nautical mile of a 1 meter swath of the ocean. And they've been doing this for 30 years, and we have this archive of something like almost 20,000 net tows. And that's really how I got started in plastics, is I started at this operation doing some teaching, and we realized that we're sitting on this gold mine of data.
I mean, because you're looking for something other than plastic and ended up finding a lot of plastic?
Right, and that's typically how all of this got started, is that everybody was doing zooplankton research, and the bycatch of the zooplankton was this plastic. And typically it was, you know, ignored or discarded, but then several groups, including Sea Education Association, started focusing on it, and at least archiving and noting the number of plastic pieces.
You talked about the fact that nobody lives out in the gyres where the plastic tends to collect. I mean, no people, certainly. But, I mean, how big is the marine life collection out there? I mean, do lots of critters live in the gyres?
Yeah, so this is an interesting topic, and one that I think I struggle with sometimes and really needs to be addressed by the community, the scientific community, in that these gyre regions are sort of the oceanic deserts of the global ocean. There's a low biodiversity, and part of that comes from having low nutrient concentration, so there's not these standing stocks of primary producers and secondary producers that drive massive fish populations. But what is different about these regions, although they have low standing stocks of biology, is that they're extremely diverse. They have, you know, their biodiversity is much higher than any other regions of the ocean. And so they're low biomass, but really high biodiversity.
Low biomass, high biodiversity. So a lot of different kinds of critters, but just not a lot of them, period.
Yeah, that's true. And they're also, you know, they're these huge parts of the region that act as, you know, as regions that large tuna, whales, they all migrate through. So it's not like there's no large sea life. They are major migratory paths through these regions as well.
All right. Given that, then, is that one of the major concerns about plastic in the ocean, is that these large migratory critters are going to come through and end up ingesting a lot of this?
Yeah, I think, you know, the bioaccumulation to the apex predators are always a major concern. And it's a proven fact that these microplastics end up in fish guts and then do, you know, get transferred up the food chain. So that is a topic. You know, we still have a lot of work to do to assess the impact, but yes, it's certainly a concern.
We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Giora Proskarowski about plastic in the ocean. He'll be delivering a talk about that very subject tomorrow night at 7 in Coos Bay at Southwestern Oregon Community College. As we go to break, let me remind you once again, it is not only day 4 of our fall fund drive here on Jefferson Public Radio, but it is also New Member Friday. Peter Sage will put $45 out of his own pocket in for every $45 new membership. If you've never been a member of JPR before, today is the best single day of the drive to join up. And a lot of people to thank as we move further into the program. Charlotte Durnell will join me later on in the program. Make that pledge of support now. Make yourself a new member if you've never done this before. 888-552-6191. 888-552-6191 or online at ijpr.org. Thanks for your support. Back on the exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Giora Proskarowski from the University of Washington, an oceanographer, research scientist, divides his research between vents on the ocean floor and plastics floating in the ocean. He'll talk about plastic in the global ocean Saturday night at 7 at the Hale Center for the Performing Arts at Southwestern Oregon Community College in Coos Bay. He's here on the exchange with us now. You can ask questions, make comments about plastic in the ocean. 800-838-3760 around the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So when we talk about plastic accumulating in the guts of the creatures out at the sea, I mean, is the plastic itself toxic? Does it just take up space in them? Does it cause them early deaths? I'm trying to figure out the effects of plastic in the bodies of sea creatures.
Yeah, so I think this is a topic that needs a lot more attention to it. Certainly, people see the albatross pictures, right, where the decomposing bodies of these albatross full of plastic are, you know, art projects and whatnot. And so, you know, seabirds are part of the sea life environment, and that certainly has had taken a toll on albatross. I think that, you know, it's hard to say if the plastic's actually toxic or if it's just, you know, filling their stomach and not allowing them to digest food properly. In fish, there's been conflicting studies whether or not plastic is toxic to fish or not. And I think that the research is landing on the side of, in some cases, it can be toxic to the fish.
Can the bodies of the critters actually digest or at least break down further the plastics? I mean, are they, or do they end up just eliminating them? Or, I mean, obviously with the shots of the, and yes, I've seen many of those pictures of the seabirds with the plastic in their guts cut open. I guess I'm asking about whether it does stay in the body for any amount of time. But as you point out, it needs more research, too.
No, they, for the most part, plastic will pass through the guts and end up in the marine environment as fecal pellets if it goes through either zooplankton or fish, small fish. There is an interesting corollary to plastic in the coastal environments in that eelgrass is made of cellulose, which is in some cases considered a polymer, but eelgrass has long been known to be consumed by fish despite the fact that fish cannot digest the cellulose. There's no mechanism in their bodies to digest the cellulose. And the reason that they're eating the eelgrass is because there's lots of algae and biofilms on that eelgrass, which is a nutrient source to these fish. And so in some ways, eelgrass has in the past been considered, the fish are farming the eelgrass and eating it. And that although they're not digesting the cellulose, the eelgrass, they're digesting all the nutrients on the eelgrass. Whether or not that applies to plastic and that's the reason why fish are eating it is an open question, but it's an interesting thought.
All right. We have an email here from Scott in Ashland. He says, given the immensity of the gyre, and in this case, I'm sure he means the North Pacific gyre, and the fragmentary nature of the plastic, is there any conceivable way to clean this up?
That is a hot topic at the moment, and there are people working on it. I think any effort, you know, any removal effort that doesn't harm the sea life is worthy. I just have my doubts that that there will be a viable mechanism. I've just, you know, I think part of it is my experience on boats in the middle of the ocean and just how wild it is out there, how huge it is, and you know, how little impacts you can have on this just tiny spot that you're sitting in. So there's been some conceptual proposals to make these very large booms that sort of filter the surface ocean and remove plastics, and you know they might help, and certainly they don't hurt if they don't fall apart. But that's the other challenge, is that the marine environment can go from flat calm to raging foam in 24 hours and then back down in another 3 days. So the environment is just incredibly dynamic, and it puts incredible stresses on anything that you place out there. So, you know, there's extreme challenges to doing long-term deployments in the ocean. So I think, you know, I think the best bet for cleanup is time and decreasing our input into the ocean. And there might be, you know, physical ways that we could make a tiny impact, but really the major impacts are going to come from time and from lessening our impact, our input into the ocean.
When I think about the prospect of trying to take boats out there, for example, and try to sweep it up, vacuum it up, something, I mean, I think if you since you mentioned the size of the patches being something like the size of the United States, this is somewhat akin then to driving a street sweeper from New York to San Francisco, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say it's like, you know, push mowing the Great Plains.
Okay.
Boats are a non-starter, really. I mean, you're doing, you know, boats are extremely expensive to operate, especially far offshore. You know, the further offshore you go, the larger a boat, the more crew you have to make an impact. And so, you know, just the carbon impact of that doesn't make any sense. So it's autonomous vehicles and sort of these large boom-type operations. So you imagine like a floating tube that stops plastic and funnels it into a central chamber. That's what a boom type operation would be. I think those are the only viable mechanisms, but you know, very difficult task.
And how do you prevent anything like that from having a bycatch anyway, that you end up taking in fish and other sea critters that you didn't intend to catch along with the plastic?
Yeah, I mean, that's a challenge. And there's I've been working with a young man out of the Netherlands, Boyan Salat, and he has some good ideas. And you know, I think, you know, his ideas are, you know, get funding, get some exposure, try it out, and see how it goes. Every little bit can't hurt, right? And especially if you can target, if you could place one of these cleanup efforts in the very most, in the centers of these polluted regions, then you could, you know, make an impact on the small scale. But it wouldn't hurt if everything stayed together.
All right. People do get a little alarmed about this. And again, as you mentioned earlier in the program, it's not like the floating garbage patch. It doesn't look like a landfill in the middle of the ocean. As you mentioned, it's something like a, you know, things that are bound to, down to the size of 1 millimeter, occupying 1 square meter each. But on the grand scheme of things, then, Dr. Proskurowski, when you think about the issues facing oceans, like global warming and acidification and stuff like that, is the plastic that high on the priority list, or is it a bit lower for you?
Yeah, Jeff, you know, this is the main point that I try to make at all of my public lectures, is that this topic resonates among the public like no other topic on the ocean. I get, you know, tons of questions about it, and people really understand it. And I think the reason people understand it is because they have a personal relationship with plastic every day. You know, almost everything you touch has plastic in it. You use it, you throw it away on a daily basis, right? Those are choices that we make every day. Things like global warming, temperature changes of 1-2 degrees centigrade, that doesn't make anybody, you know, that doesn't make sense to anybody, right? How can 2 degrees centigrade change have a big impact? Or how can lowering pH slightly have an impact, right? People don't understand that, you know, carbon CO2 concentrations going up from 370 to 400 to 425 ppm. Again, it doesn't resonate with anybody because nobody knows what those are. You can't even see CO2, right? So plastic is a very physical, very personal, you have a relationship with it. And I think that's why it resonates with people, unlike, say, global climate change, rising CO2, lowering pH, that type of issue. And so although this issue resonates with people, it doesn't have that same impact in the environment that the more important issues do. And so I always say that there are huge major, major problems facing the ocean. And plastic is an example, an analog to them, but is really not at the same scale. It doesn't pose a threat to the global oceans that you know, falling pHs and rising temperatures do.
Is it disrupting the food chain in the sense that there are things that are coming about to digest? We have a question here from Bill in Arcata who dropped it off. Wants to know about bacteria that ingest the plastic. Anything like that appearing out there?
Yeah, I mean, anything that you put in the ocean is going to get populated by bacteria, and the ocean is an amazing incubator. There are species and bacteria, microorganisms doing incredible things in the oceans that we have no idea about what they can do. And so anything you put in the ocean is going to get altered by the ocean. In this case, there's so much input into the ocean that it's actually changing the environment in the ocean. You know, whether it's changing it for the good or the bad is an open question, but there's no doubt that the environment is being changed and the ocean is responding to this input of plastic.
Well, we've learned a lot today, and folks can learn a lot more tomorrow. Dr. Giora Proskorowski's conversation at Southwestern Oregon Community College is called Plastic in the Global Ocean, Saturday night at 7 at the Hale Center for the Performing Arts in Coos Bay. And you can get in for free, but if you're living outside the area, you can also view it live on the web. The live stream, a link on the college website, which is socc.edu, socc.edu. For Dr. Giora Proskorowski's talk tomorrow night at 7. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, thanks. You had some great questions. And I don't want to belittle the whole topic, but I am at the University of Washington, but I'm born and raised in Eugene, and I'm a Duck, and so go Ducks tonight.
All right. Well said. Thanks for that, Giora. Take care.